It talks about something called a coherent sense of time, and that is seeing yourself fully in the past, present, and future. And conflict transformation essentially does that, because what you're doing is you are needing to honor the pain and the challenges and the histories and the narratives, all of that from the past, but doing so in a way that isn't just exploiting them or minimizing them, but honoring them, meaning finding some kind of kernel of truth in them, a meaning, something important that can carry with you. And, you know, being able to, in the moment, you know, kind of transform the present in the sense of you're not fearing tension, you're bringing people together for open conversations, and then you are investing together in a shared future.
Welcome to episode 38 of the Mind That Ego podcast. I'm Ricky DeRiz, and today I'm joined by Dr. Michelle DeMarco, an award-winning writer and author of Holding On to Air, The Art and Science of Building a Resilient Spirit. Michelle is a trained therapist, clinical ethicist, and researcher. Her research includes moral injury, psychology, trauma, neuroscience, and somatic and creative art therapies, world wisdom, and spirituality. She has taught creative nonfiction and conflict transformation at California Institute of Integral Studies, and our conversation focuses on the subject of Michelle's series, How to Tend and Befriend Conflict. If we accept conflict as necessary and natural, transformation becomes possible. In the conversation, we explore the errors of conventional conflict resolution, how to connect to the body's wisdom, detecting underlying issues, defense mechanisms, and exploring the five different conflict styles. We then go deeper into nuances such as accommodating other points of view without losing integrity, opening to feedback, and giving and receiving grace as a means to create more harmony. I find our conversation immensely invaluable, and I'm sure if you're human and also struggle with conflict with other humans, you will too. Enjoy. So I just personally really struggle with what I see as, you know, some kind of a tragedy, really, of loving someone, and yet the people that you love being the people that end up seeing like the messiness, the reactivity, the shadow, like the difficulty of conflict.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my personal interest is, and as your article and the series really helped was to illuminate it, and also to feel a degree of empowerment around. You don't have to be stuck in conflict. There are ways through. There are approaches that can work. So that's my kind of personal slant on it.
It's a good slant.
Yeah, I think that like emotional investment is worthwhile.
I think that's resonant with so many people. I think that's actually one of the things that's about this is that even though conflict transformation grew out of, you know, large groups working together at kind of like an international level, it completely resonates at a personal level or even a professional level. I mean, it can be used, it can be applied in your own life, personal relationships, or at work, or, you know, elsewhere. So, it's just a mindset.
The growth mindset, looking to see how it can transform.
Yeah.
In your experience, because my sense is that this might not be accurate, but do you find that almost like the more you love someone or the more that you're attached to someone, the higher the likelihood of conflict?
Oh, I think so. Well, it's also proximity. I mean, at its core, conflict is relational. So, I mean, and for some reason, whenever I say that to people and when I heard it the first time, it kind of is like an, oh, duh, of course it is. But you don't think of it that way, or a lot of folks don't think of it that way. So it's always this thing that we puff our chests up about, you know, it's like conflict, like I'm defensive, I'm ready for it. When it's like, well, no, conflict is really just, it's both natural and necessary because it is, excuse me, I thought I was going to sneeze. it's just a disruption of, you know, a relationship, a bond, you know, One of the things conflict is its proximity. If you're going back to what you were just saying about your personal relationship, that's the person closest in proximity to you, both in physical space and in emotional space. If you're spiritually oriented, in spiritual space, and of course, those things are going to bump up into each other. They're also the things that you typically invest in the most. So the things you hold on to those things, you know, tighter and stronger, and are more sensitive to them. So I think one of the biggest things for people to think about conflict when they, because it really, so many people get so worked up about it and defensive about it or fearful of it, and it's really not something to fear. And it is something, if we didn't have conflict in our life, life would be incredibly boring. It would not be moving. It would not be growing. It really is necessary for growth and change. And that, I think if you shift your mind to that stance, you know, and you operate from that stance, your whole attitude about it changes. It lessens the defensive mechanisms.
Yeah. Cause it can, like, I know I felt that as if conflict is getting in the way of harmony rather than conflict being a pathway to harmony. So that
yeah,
shift.
And opening up things. I mean, conflict,
yeah.
I mean, have you, ask you, have you ever had a time when you were in a relationship and you had a big fight or you had some conflict erupted? And once you worked through it, you feel this amazing sense of relief from it afterwards. It's like,
yeah.
Oh, and when you're in that, well, I guess I asked that question, so I'll give you a chance to respond to it.
Yeah, no, of course. The relief, even a sense of fulfillment when it's navigated and there is a resolution. Yeah, I feel the relief and also like, oh, we've worked together to maybe not achieve something, but to kind of work through to a deeper understanding.
One of the things that conflict transformation does is it doesn't require an absolute solution, as if everything's always going to be like, it's not an endpoint to achieve. It's really something that's like, oh, we've taken a step forward. That's opened up new doors. Now we can keep going. It's like it opens the path up as opposed to closing the path, where it's like a resolution approach is like, okay, we had a problem, we resolved it. Now we move on with our lives. And that can work for small problems. You know, you have an issue with the fence in the backyard with the neighbor, and it's like, you know, okay, well, we move the fence, and you know, but if you don't, well, to continue that analogy, if you talk to your neighbor a lot and you're having a fight, well, you actually have a shared investment in your space. So the reason sometimes actually conflict resolution doesn't work is when the relationship is actually, when you're investing more in the relationship, if the relationship is a long-term thing. It's one of the things that helps navigate conflict is to figure out the quality of relationship, the type of relationship that you're in, how invested are you in it? How long are you in it for, and to what degree? So if it's with your spouse or your partner, well, presumably you're in it for the long haul. You're in it in a deep way. So just resolving an issue, you know, isn't, sometimes it's a bigger issue.
Yeah.
Where so many... a transformation process can be more helpful.
Yeah. I know we said about structure, but I'm just going to follow this for now. Because what, also in your experience, like how, you know, the underlying, So there are patterns of conflict, and like you say, that there's the potential to transform through it, the mindset shift of embracing conflict. And I imagine the myth of romantic love and all the misconceptions that come with that, and like this idea of perfection, color that in a certain way. But how and to what degree do you feel that underlying deeper issues then masquerade as individual conflict? And I say that as someone, like I say, in my intimate relationships, have just found patterns, cycles of togetherness, rupture, togetherness, rupture, togetherness, rupture, working through insight, breakthrough, and at the same time, not actually feeling able to get a lot of clarity on what that underlying issue might be. So I'm interested in your perspective on how common it is to do with a deeper cause, and also how to identify what those causes could be.
Sure. I think the well, it also depends on the situation. So, sometimes, as I think I wrote about in that piece, sometimes moving a closet or cleaning a room or something isn't just cleaning a room. Sometimes there's bigger issues to it. So if you have a situation where you have somebody isn't putting their clothes, you're living together, somebody's really messy, somebody's really neat. Let me back up and maybe I'll talk about the two approaches that are historically people do approach conflict as, and then maybe I can work my way to that, if that works for you. Okay.
That sounds good. And maybe just a brief overview of your definition of conflict as well, just to, yeah, sort of.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. So, my view of conflict is that it's essentially just a natural disruption of human relationships. There's a great quote that says that it's what happens. Conflict happens when two people or two issues are sharing a space. And what that gets at is that conflict is really very, very relational at its core. Another one is that it's elements that are in opposition and that they're striking against each other. So what you can see is that it's really just frankly relational, and you have whether it's yeah it's just basically it's natural. This is what happens when human beings are together sharing a space. You get differences in perspectives, differences in emotions, differences in experience, attachment styles. It's a big mess of all of life, when it comes together. And anytime you have that, things are going to bump up against each other. And so I think a lot of the anxiety around conflict is in not understanding and not embracing that it is natural and it is something that's just bound to happen. So when you shift that to that stance, suddenly the defensiveness comes down at least a little bit. So it's like, okay, I'm having a fight with my partner. We've got, I'm really ticked off at something. Well, that's just you maybe you're valid in your, validate your feelings that's the situation. But it would be unnatural to assume that the fact that it happens is a problem. So do you see what I'm saying? Like conflict is bound to happen, So the question isn't that conflict itself is bad. It's how you engage it.
Yeah. And I don't want to take you too far off the on a tangent, but how knowing and having that mindset shift and knowing that it's natural, how then do you identify how much conflict is too much conflict?
Well, I think you have conflict can be like, you know, sedimentary rocks. It gets just layered and layered and layered and layered. And then oftentimes it doesn't get addressed. And then you have a big Vesuvius eruption.
Yeah, I can relate.
so can I. I think it's not necessarily about waiting until Vesuvius is, you know, shaking in the ground. It's about acknowledging and recognizing when there are, you know, little tremors, to continue the metaphor, and to say, okay, something's happening there. Like I'm sensing something. And that actually is, we often think of conflict with our minds. And we think about it. People say, no, just think differently about it. No, sorry, my little bubbles. Yeah, I don't know.
That's the universe.
I'm
approving
Italian
of this
and I
conversation.
Talk with my hands. So every time I'm on Zoom, I got bubbles like and things bursting in the background. So apologies. Now I have to go back to what I was to remember what I was just saying.
So around like sense in the, yeah, you usually looking at the mind as the tool.
The mind is the tool.
That's
yes.
a common approach.
And you're thinking about like, I'm mad. It's all thought driven. This person did that. I'm doing this. That's not fair to me, you know, and it's very thought driven. Where what often will both tell you something isn't working isn't necessarily the thoughts. It's your body's response to those thoughts. And one of the things that I don't see enough in conflict, practices when people are trying to do it, is how to keep in touch with what's happening inside of you. Because that tells you a lot. It's called interoception, which is a way of being mindful about what's happening, sensing what you're feeling, whether that's, you know, a quickening heart or, you know, your stomach lurches or something, you know, and it's like, that's telling you something. So even at going back to what we were just saying about, you know, when you can acknowledge conflict or when you're sensing it, being in touch, like being in your body and being able to say like, okay, I'm noticing right now that, you know, my heart is like racing because I'm so angry right now. Saying like, okay, well, that's going to tell you something. Or, geez, something just doesn't feel right. I'm getting a, you know, a sense of it. That actually is a good signal or a good flag to say, maybe we need to have a conversation about this, or maybe I need to take a step back from it and do some thinking about it before I enter that conversation. So it's a way, a different kind of way in.
Yeah, and the body tends to be kind of up to speed, doesn't it? It's ahead of the game in some way.
I think it's ahead of the game in a lot of. It's got a lot of information for us, and you know, I was somebody who for the majority of my life lived in my head, and that can be great. It's, you know, I'm not trying to downplay the mind by any stretch of the imagination, but when I started looking at, you know, somatic aspects and how that actually influences our thoughts and our behaviors, there was a lot there. I mean, it's paying attention, like this thing that we inhabit, that we are. I mean, it has a lot of wisdom in it, and we're wise to pay attention to it. But that is also a process of learning and getting, you know, used to it too. So
I will lead into the different approaches, but from that, one thing that comes to mind is empathy. And I talk from my perspective. I know upbringing, complex traumas, mechanisms that I have can make me vigilant in those relationships. So there's like a the aspect of my trust in my body for where I am at, but also empathy and empathizing and being highly sensitive and noticing what I perceive as a shift. I'll just say in my partner, I'll just use the term partner as a catch-all, but like it, just in general. And almost wanting, and I think this has been a part of the issue that I found is if I'm sensitive to that shift, perceived shift, because it might be that I'm projecting something, that I can almost rush into a conversation or rush into wanting to be. To resolve if there's like discomfort within myself of okay, I don't feel comfortable because I think this person might be pissed off with me for some reason. Like, should we talk about it? So there's, I think what I'm trying to articulate is I've sensed within myself maybe rushing in to conversation, and on the opposite, because it feels uncomfortable, avoiding the conversation. So with that, how would you guide someone of identifying that? Almost like not necessarily the sweet spot. Like you say, it's trial and error. You're never going to get perfect, but what are the cues that you would follow? Like now is a good time to talk about it because I know I don't want to avoid and I don't want to jump in. Like how would you discern that?
Well, it's funny because I my typical style is the same way. It's like I just go right into it and just talk about it. And yeah, and there are times when that's a good thing to do, and there are times when that isn't, as I've learned through bitter experience.
Yeah, me too.
So okay, so I think what is helpful is A, being able to notice when you want to lurch. So it's like, I'm noticing I really want to lurch. So how do I step back from that movement to say, okay, what I need to do is step back from that, what I would say is an autonomic response, and I can come back and talk about that. It's a nervous system response speaks to attachment styles. So I'll get back to some of that in a minute. But being able to step back from that, assess whether or not this is a time that is important to talk right now. Is it an emergency? Like, are we in an emergency situation where we need to actually talk about this now because danger is going to happen if we don't have this conversation? Or would it be more helpful to go take a walk, get some fresh air, take some deep breaths, come back, and then either present the like, I'm feeling like I need to be able to talk to you about this because I'm feeling anxious about it. You're kind of not wanting to. We have to kind of, and even if you're able to engage a conversation that is about having a conversation, then that actually is helpful. But I think it would be maybe helpful to stop me if not, but to talk about what happens inside of us when conflict happens. Would that be
Absolutely. Yeah.
helpful?
Yeah,
Okay.
please do.
So, and it's actually fairly straightforward. This is another thing. We all get, it's so, like conflict. Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. It's like totally, again, back to the natural thing. So our bodies are geared for survival. We have a nervous system that has two primary branches. One is the sympathetic nervous system, which is the one that is geared for survival. It's the fight, flight, freeze response that tell our body is sensing, our nervous system is sensing that something, that there's a threat out there, and it's readying us for that threat, whether we're going to fight it off, whether we're going to run and flee from it, whether we're going to play dead because that's the safest, the safest option. And this goes back to the primitive, you know, primitive areas of the brain and all of that. Then there's the parasympathetic nervous system, which is what they typically call the tend and befriend, rest and digest system. It's the one that typically keeps us functioning, normal functions. You know, we can eat, swallow, go to the bathroom, you know, all that kind of stuff. And so when a threat comes along, it shifts from a parasympathetic, normal, just functioning state into a conserve of resources state. So it's reserve, you know, readying us. So what ends up happening in the brain is that the rational area of the brain, the newer area of the brain that allows us to stay calm and think clearly and all of that, just goes offline. And so it immediately goes to the threat area in the primitive part of the brain. So we're not thinking clearly anymore. So the things that we might say in a moment would not necessarily be the things that we would say if we were not in that agitated survival focused state. So what ends up happening is it's something as simple as you're in the kitchen, somebody's doing dishes, somebody says something, not, you know, and you get that response. It's purely a threat response. Something somebody said, something somebody did, you are perceiving as a threat. And so suddenly you go into that place and that kind of survival protective place. And some of that, you know, if we look at trauma, it also goes back to attachment styles in, you know, early childhood. And this is a whole other conversation. I don't want to take us so far unless you want to go down that road. But, you know, there's various attachment styles, people that need to talk about something really quickly because they have a really close attachment style, or people who don't want to because they have an avoidance, you know, style. And those triggers can then launch us into survival mode easily, depending on what the situation is. So if you are in the situation, back to what you said with your partner, and you have this need to want to talk about everything right now, what's happening is something inside of you is being set off, whether because that's an attachment style from, you know, your younger years that you've developed, or whatever it is, it's being perceived as some kind of threat, whether that's a threat of losing the person, a threat of relation and bonding. And it's like, that's what makes you want to lurch. Like, I don't want to lose this. I think we can talk it out. I don't want problems, you know, and so I think that's the mechanism that gets you to that response. So if you follow through with that response, then that can heighten the conflict in certain situations. Whereas if you know that about yourself, and you can in a moment try to, when you're starting, if you get yourself at like a level 2 or 3 of conflict, not like Vesuvius at a 9 or 10, you're not quite, you haven't quite completely lost your rational mind, you know, so you're still at that level of, I can step into this and say, geez, I'm noticing that I'm really feeling the need to get clutchy or lurchy. And okay, that's telling me something. So is this, so then you can, you know, there are certain practices that you can do to help stay in that rational mind. And then you can assess, is now the time to talk about it? Do we need to have a conversation about talking about it? Do we need to push it off till later? Do I just need to go take a walk and come back to it?
Thanks for sharing
that.
That of course. Yeah, absolutely. And for the sake of balance, I want to acknowledge that I definitely do both. I don't always, and I can feel that lurch mechanism from one aspect, probably more in that fight response. So even if I'm have the intention of communicating is good, it probably comes across as either aggressive or threatening. If I'm just, let's just be real, it probably comes across in that way. But also, there are times where I can really feel withdrawn, and I would say I oscillate between the two. And as you're sharing that, I'm thinking of those occasions and if there are different triggers between when I want to withdraw and when I'm more like, no, I'm going to confront this.
Do you ever withdraw? Because sometimes when the fight flight is so, like, it's not working, you can't do either, not you can't flee and you can't fight and stuff, you end up in more of a shutdown place. It's the body's natural, and it's a self-protection thing, and it does force people to withdraw. And so it may be sometime, it depends on the situation, but I think, you know, if there's been more explosions or something like that, sometimes it's just like, I'm past the point of that. There's no way to reconcile this, so I am just withdrawn.
Yeah. And I think when, like you mentioned, the layers that build up, and I think over time, when it is chronic or repeated, there can just be almost like burnout, like relational burnout. And I know that I'm not alone in my relationship and feeling that. We've both felt it. And yeah, I've really had to work on that shutdown mechanism. That's been the shutdown mechanism on one side, and then, yeah, as I say, too much fight, you know, and then saying stuff that I regret and just like, oh, why did I say that? It's not who I want to be. And now I'm witnessing like my shadow, this image of me that is so unfavorable, and why? with that in mind, as well, I've noticed, and I'd be interested on your take in terms of, you mentioned the defensiveness, and it's like the complexity of defense mechanisms. So, for example, one of them for me can be feigning power or strength, like if I feel threatened. So like feigning that through being more assertive or confrontational, or I don't know, there are so many. This is way too much to go into, but I'd be interested in, sorry, your take on the different defense mechanisms when they come online and how to notice and work with those. So you have like the body response, but then the way that the mind might try and work its way out, either through blame or these different responses to conflict.
It's a really thoughtful question and a good one. And the short answer is curiosity. One of the things, and that's probably not an obvious response, but when you are noticing what's going on in you, it's not just that you're noticing it. You have to get curious about them, about what it is. Like, what is this trying to tell me? And I think it pulls you back from kind of reactive behavior to assessing behavior, which puts a pause in the action, quite literally. Yeah. One of the, you know, well, tell, I could go down a number, a couple different routes. Dig in a little bit. Where would you like me to dig in?
Good question. I just checked the time. We're good. How long do you have? I didn't ask you before. I do this.
I'm good.
Every time I forget to ask at the beginning. So every podcast recording, I'm like, how are you doing for time?
I'm good. I'm good.
Okay, great.
Enjoying the conversation.
Okay, great. So yeah, something that I really work on, and it's also been supported by Sanya, by my partner in the process of heart opening. Mm-hmm. And like I say, those defense mechanisms and the way that I act when vulnerable and then self-protecting, which actually initially feels easier because it's a deeply ingrained habit. It feels easier for me to shut off, pretend that I'm fine, pretend that I'm not bothered, pretend I'm not upset. Usually it's easier for me to go to anger than it mm-hmm. is to go to sadness or just to feel that vulnerability. So in terms of going more into that, I'd be interested in your approach to being like centered in the heart and trying to remain vulnerable amidst conflict and noticing that, bringing that curiosity to, oh, I'm actually closing my heart right now. And I think that, you know, most people, they have good reason to, they've learned through pain and heartbreak to close and shut off. But I think ultimately that's not what you want in a relationship. You want to be open-hearted, you want to be loving. How would you approach that in terms of remaining open-hearted in vulnerability?
Well, and it's a brilliant question. I go back to what I was saying about knowing what's happening inside of you, because what ends up happening often in conflict is when we feel under threat, feel attacked, and our rational brain kind of goes offline, it shuts down empathy. Because if you go back to, well, there's a big bear coming at me, I can't really love it because it's going to eat me alive. You know, if you just go back to the old school analogy,
come here, you,
like,
come here.
Come here, look, you're a big bear. but so we don't, so, I mean, this is all natural. Like these are normal, natural ways that our bodies are trying to help us survive. Sometimes they just get a little overly sensitive.
Yeah.
And we have to pull them back from the brink and say, no, the bear isn't coming. We're just having a disagreement about something and we can get through that. Keeping your heart open, being able to empathize, being able to be vulnerable, all of that is not going to happen if you are in a heightened, agitated, dysregulated state. So really being able to be empathetic, to love, to be open, to be vulnerable with somebody in that moment, it ain't gonna happen if you're in that space. So really being able to what's called titrate your emotions mm-hmm. so that you can keep the ebb and flow of them moving in a healthy way. You can acknowledge when something's getting a little much, you know how to pull back from that, you know how to lean into it when you need to. That is really the fundamental thing that you can do in order to engage conflict well.
How, as an extension of that, how do you discern, like you mentioned, the timing might not be right, it might be overwhelming, it might be that you need space, and I imagine, you know, in a loving relationship, that's a given, that's a boundary. Like if that's not respected, then that's clearly another cause for conflict. But how do you discern when actually, and I imagine this applies more to people you don't know so intimately, and there's less investment, but knowing when to not be as open as a wise choice, as a boundary of, actually in this situation, my open-heartedness is making me vulnerable in a way that probably isn't wise. If that makes sense as a
Yeah, you need
question.
a little bit more protection in this in that case, where it's like the boundaries are too loose. It goes back to in that moment being able to gauge it. And being able to say and trusting your instincts and what your body's telling you, which might be, I'm feeling particularly vulnerable right now. And sometimes actually saying to the person that you're, ooh, excuse me, have a little Maine Coon kitty who loves Zoom. And she moves too quickly, so I can't stop her before she
All
leaves.
good.
Sorry about that. But being able to, like I was saying, being able to, in a moment, say, geez, I'm noticing, like, I'm feeling more vulnerable right now, which is going to make me actually say and do things that I wouldn't otherwise say, whether that's because I'm going to leap out in defense or whether I'm really going to pull away and give in a way that maybe I didn't want to, or that isn't authentic. And what's happening is that once again, you're being activated, like, physiologically activated. And so being able to even say in your case to your partner, I'm feeling particularly vulnerable right now, and now is not the time to have that conversation. I want to have that conversation, or we need to have that conversation, or we need to engage this issue in some way, but now is not that time. And I give you a little piece of my own experience, which somebody once told me that I always needed to have the last, literally the last word. So it would, and always, I always needed a final, like I needed to be the period or the exclamation point at the end of the sentence in any fight. And of course, I was completely defensive about that for a long. No, I do not, and then period, or exclamation. And I'm like,
Just
oh,
proving
Michelle,
the
what are you thinking? But it was true. And then I started. Then I, when I allowed. The when I allow when I approached it with what I like to call benevolent honesty, which is a kindness and gentleness with yourself, but that's also clear-eyed, to say, well, you don't have to be perfect, and maybe you do need the last word all the time, and maybe that's not always helpful because that's not allowing somebody else to have the space. But again, that's that lurch response that we were talking about earlier. That's and so. I was able to say, oh, okay, let me get out of my, attack mode. Let me get curious about that. Turns out probably was true. I catch myself and then I say, if I'm now feeling in a if going, if I'm now in a situation where I want to have the last word or I want to have that, I'll step back from it myself. Kind of ground and say, okay, is this really going to be helpful? Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. Sometimes it's also you're able to say, I have more to say on this, but now isn't the time to say it, and I'll express it later. But I'm honoring what your needs at the moment. You know what I mean? Like I'm honoring how you need to hear that. And so it really is being able to gauge and assess and be curious, probably in the reverse order, in about what's going on, and then being able to say, okay. And again, sometimes we get in conflict, we get so lost in the content of the conflict, not and it's so we, that it prevents us from actually being able to say things like, there's more to say on this, but now is not the time. Or I do think that this is an important issue that we need to talk about or we need to address, but I'm not in a state right now that I can do that well. And so let's find a time when we can. So it's being able to talk about more than just the content, but the process of what's going on and the context of what's going on, engaging everybody, because if you're not setting yourself up for, you're not setting yourself up for success if you're just lurching into things that are in a bad way. Now, sometimes emergencies happen and we need to solve things. And, you know, I don't know if we want to go to conflict styles yet, but if that's something you wanted to talk about, but I'll just say generally that there are five conflict styles, and each one of those, we tend towards one or two of them in some ways, but all five of them are really important for mm-hmm. how to engage conflict, because there are certain instances where avoiding is a good thing. You know, everybody typically goes, oh, no, I avoid conflict like the plague. You know, you hear that all the time. And it's like, well, no, sometimes conflict is good. If somebody is like road raging, you know,
mm-hmm.
engaging that and sticking your middle finger up or something is probably not going to be helpful.
Yeah.
In that, or potentially be dangerous. So if, you know, there's all also under really understanding the context of the conflict and knowing when it's good to compromise, when it's good to collaborate, when it's good to avoid. These are super helpful things.
Yeah.
At a small level that will help you to engage conflict well.
It becomes apparent having this conversation why relationships are probably the most difficult and also have the most potential to really do the messy work. Be it as like personal development or even a spiritual practice, like the amount of complexity and humbling. Oh, that's something I find. Like there's a humbling process to all of this, isn't there? It's
very.
Yeah. You mentioned the conflict styles. So it was avoidance.
Oh, yeah.
We can go over those briefly because I think they're helpful to pinpoint what tendencies people might have.
Sure. Yes, of course. So it's called the Thomas Kilman conflict instrument is basically developed five conflict styles that most people tend toward in one or two ways, especially. They are competing, which is essentially like, you know, my way.
Mm.
And that's like, I got to get what I want no matter what. You know, some people are going to win, some people are going to lose. There's collaborating, which would be our way. And that's kind of finding a solution that makes everybody happy. Looking closely at like the sources of the conflict and then working together. There's accommodating, which is your way, mm-hmm. which is giving in to somebody else's needs, perspectives, desires, and paying less attention to your own and more and privileging theirs. There's avoiding, as we talked about, which is basically, you know, pretending nothing's wrong, denying that there's a problem, walking away from a problem, you know, that. And there's compromising. And that's kind of the halfway. And that's where each person wins some and loses some. And so, and send you the link if you want to post it with this, but there's an assessment, a free assessment that people can do online. And
I did it. I reread it.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. I'm.
Isn't it fun?
It is fun. Yeah. I was, what was it? I think it was Compromiser and there was another one. Because it does percentages, right? The one that's,
it does like, percentages.
Yeah. Mostly Compromiser. I think there was another one. Is that a good, because you said there, it depends. It's contextual. It's not like one's better than the other, but.
Exactly. So unlike some of the other personality tests and things out there that are more, this is, you tend towards these things. So, mm-hmm. And they, like you said, they give you a percentage and, you know, so it's like, okay, I tend to be a compromiser and an avoider.
Yeah.
Say. Okay. And then those are like the high areas I'm scoring. In other words, I'm scoring over 60 on that, mm-hmm. you know? I'm less a competitor and all of that. Now, most people then make all kinds of presumptions about what that, or assumptions about what that is. Like, oh, I'm an avoider. I don't, you know, I can't do conflict and, you know, but like I said, it's actually, so it, this tool does two things. It allows you to, kind of understand your natural inclination, but it also helps you to see how different contexts of conflict require different approaches. And so the good news is that you can build up, once you have some knowledge about this stuff and can practice it, you can build it up so that you can start to acknowledge, like, this would be a good situation where we collaborate. You know, we have a shared investment. We've got, you know, we live together. We've got this long, we have a long-term investment of a relationship. This specific issue, we need to figure out how, you know, we can find a solution that makes us, that works for both of us.
Mm.
You know, but there's other times where, like I said, you don't have a long-term investment in a, you know, so avoiding maybe helpful. It may also be that in a moment, like we go back to where you feel particularly vulnerable. Well, it may be that you need to avoid and say, now's not the time. I'm not becoming an ostrich. I'm not putting my head in the sand and never gonna deal with it. But now is not that time. So I'm gonna now practice an avoidance, approach out of a place of self-protection, and so that I don't say and do things that I wouldn't otherwise want to do.
Yeah. I also think that the example that comes to mind where that would be skillful is in a relationship or a dynamic where you've expressed boundaries that aren't being respected.
Yes.
And then they're still not respecting them. So it's like, okay, I'm actually going to avoid because I know it's not going to be respected. And now I'm playing a game in my mind. I'm like, oh, when does each work? What context? Because like the more of a it wasn't confrontational. What was the one, like, us
competing? Yep.
An example that comes to mind, like doing, and you might experience this as well, like doing this kind of work, having a presence, sharing ideas without being dogmatic. I notice how some people just come at me, what I'm saying, with no, you can tell there's no desire to actually accommodate and be like, oh, I see what you're saying, this is my view. They just want to show that they know more than I do. And this is something I've noticed the more that I'm getting reach, getting people respond and just sharing their view on what I'm openly putting into the world. And I want to be creative and I want to accommodate people. And it might be a talk or presentation as well. Like that could be another context for this. I want to accommodate and be like, okay, yeah, I understand where you're coming from. This is my view. I'll take that on board. But noticing when, A, someone is just taking up space. Like some people, like some people just want to take up space in these containers and just be like, no, this is how I, and you're like, yeah, I get that. I'm not saying this is the way that reality works or whatever, but just to acknowledge within myself how I've had to refine competing against the consensus ideas, the consensus of people's misconceptions or stereotypes, particularly around mental health and spirituality and that overlap. So that's an example that comes to mind for
that's a great example. You know, to be honest, I hadn't thought about it that way before, but it's actually super smart, because what's interesting about that is that if we opted for, or in your case, in, you know, the situation you just said, if you opted for a competing approach to dealing with what it's like, okay, I'm getting this tension. Now you're, this person's like unnecessarily pushing back, you know, in kind of a blowhard kind of way. I'm paraphrasing clearly, but if you took that competing approach, it would just anger you. It would not turn into something, it would increase your anger because now you're going at it, you know, it would ratchet things up in that instance. As opposed to saying, you know, if you take the, I'm just, you know, I'm going to accommodate, not that I'm giving actually something of myself up. It's more, well, actually what I think you're doing is you're giving grace at some level, and you're also letting the person show themselves to be the person that you are, but you're maintaining your integrity and you're offering grace to them, you're maintaining your integrity, and you haven't lost anything, you know? So there's, it's almost, that is a way actually that you can remain whole in a conflict, which is a really interesting use of the accommodating approach. Super interesting.
Oh,
That's
thank you.
a
The
great example.
sense of validation is off the charts right now. I love it. Like because with that as well, I've noticed, because I've just sensed that this is going to be, it's just going to become an increase in challenge that I face. I just sense that. Maybe I'm manifesting that, but there's also like a window of accommodation almost, because you know this idea of give someone an inch, they'll take a mile. And people that are very open-hearted, very compassionate, and actually, no, I can't accommodate your view. You can then sense that there has to be a moment of like a real skill in accommodating, like you say, from a place of wholeness and as an act of grace, and then knowing when to be like, okay, no, I'm done now. Like, respectfully, I've accommodated enough.
Well, and that's when you can then shift into it. At this point, my integrity and is going to be compromised. And so now I'm going to shift into an avoidance, which is basically I'm going to extricate myself from the situation. So fantastic example.
And there was also, yeah, so the compromise. Now I'm getting carried away. I want to give good examples for all of them. Let's move on before I do that.
I love hearing them. No, go ahead. Seriously. It's super helpful for people though to hear. It's one thing to just throw out these terms, but to hear how what it looks like in real life, I think is super helpful. So keep at it.
Well, it's because it strikes me that in like interrelational dynamics, and I'm someone that particularly in recent years, I don't want to say withdrawn, because there's been a purpose behind being in solitude more, I don't even want to say refining my friendships, just not energizing friendships as much, really reassessing what I want from relationships. So I'm not in the mix as much as I used to be. I'm not always having these kind of conversations or even frequently, but I'm intrigued by, I think, the relationships that I do have. There's a certain depth to those conversations and understanding. And yet, a lot of, not necessarily advice, but approaches, they do tend to simplify and overlook just nuance, like, which is, this is a good example of the nuances of, it's not one size fits all. It changes dependent on the relationship, the context, and as you noted, it could even change in the middle of the conflict itself, where another approach becomes optimal. And I've noticed that with compassion and even the idea in spiritual circles of unconditional love being something that is a human, like, possible for humans to always be, and how that doesn't actually, you try putting that in the kind of field, and it doesn't it just doesn't
No, it's
work.
land.
It just doesn't land, and it's not actually practical for the complexities of relationships.
Well, you know, and it's interesting how, and this could also go down a different road, but it's interesting you mentioned compassion and what you just said, and you know, the universe, love, and how that kind of compassion also comes up against dignity and integrity. And when compassion is you know, when it's become, when it moves from being healthy to unhealthy, when dignity and integrity start to become compromised.
That's a great point. Yeah. I'm with in that space over the risk of over empathizing with someone's point of view, like you say, to the point of losing dignity, of having people and relationships that aren't respecting boundaries or have certain just unpleasant or unsupportive dynamics that are just, oh, I understand where that person's coming from. I think this is something that can a trap potential trap is if you understand where someone's coming from, and if you understand their motivations, that can actually then become like a qualifier to endorse unpleasant behavior or unfavorable because you understand from a place of empathy. So does that make sense?
100, yes, a
Yeah.
complete sense. A very good point. It's interesting because empathy out of the gate, it's like, no, that's a positive thing. We should all have empathy. And I'm not in any way suggesting empathy is a negative problem, is negative or a problem. However, it can be, to your point, if the boundaries around it aren't held in a healthy way. What ends up happening too is that a lot of people talk about empathy and they in theory are giving that to someone else, whereas it's really just about kind of virtue signaling for themselves that like I'm a super good person because I'm understanding things too. So, I guess it's like anything else, the Goldilocks principle, too much, too little, just right. And it's an oversimplification, but it again, it's being mindful of when things are shifting. Where is this empathy coming from? How is it being used? Is it, if empathy is essentially the feeling and compassion is the act, am I just living in empathy, but I'm not actually doing something? And is sometimes the best thing I could do, the most compassionate act would be to actually draw a better boundary.
Yeah. Yes. Yes, especially with I like the Buddhist terminology, the way they break down compassion in different ways, and one of them, just the understanding, is to suffer with and understand someone else, but to take action in order to alleviate that suffering. Like everything, that what I've just said can also be weaponized, and it is by certain spiritual teachers for sure. Because it's like, oh, I'm just being compassionate. I'm just destroying your ego for your own. It's like, no, chill out, really. But yeah, I say that because breaking repeated habitual patterns, especially in family dynamics,
Oh, yes.
when you actually notice those dynamics and you know that communicating is going to cause at least short-term temporary upset through setting boundaries, through calling out behavior. There's like a, oh God, this is going to be difficult, but it's the most compassionate thing because I can see how these habitual ingrained behaviors are causing more suffering. Whereas if I have the courage to disrupt those patterns, it's going to potentially create an initial reaction, but then for hopefully for greater, more organic, conscious harmony through that.
It's difficult in the short term, but you're investing in the long term. And one of the things that is, really tough for people is discomfort and sitting with discomfort. And and that is as you just in the example you just gave, that's exactly it. It's like, I know this is not going to feel good for a while, and I know this is going to cause certain things, and it may cause long-term things in certain people. You
Completely,
don't
it
know.
might could revolutionize or completely change the dynamic, right? It's not.
It completely, and there has to be a rec you have to reconcile yourself to that and live and be able to live with that uncertainty that you don't know. You can't You can't control all the outcomes. It may do this, it may not. But I know from a place of calm and centered that this is what is right. This is what needs to be happened in order for integrity, dignity, all of those wholeness to exist. And that isn't easy. And that does take some courage, and it does take resilience, and it takes, you know, all kinds of things. But but to kind of pull back to the, so how do you sit with discomfort? Some of that is acknowledging, you know, some of that's patience, and that's living, you know, with moderation and perspective throughout difficult and uncertainty. You know, being in touch with yourself to say, like, okay, I'm really feeling this right now. Like, okay, I'm really worried about it. Now I'm like ratcheting up and saying, okay, what can I do to just, you know, get in the present, do something, calm things down so that I get out of that space. You know, there's I think lots of things that we can do, but I don't think as a society we do necessarily a good job of sitting with discomfort or helping people to sit with discomfort. I mean, unfortunately, life's full of discomfort. And sometimes, and discomfort, like any emotion, it has, you know, that experience has something to tell us. You know, there's wisdom in it.
There are a few different directions to go in. I'm conscious of the time as well. One thing, more than one, there are many. I'll share and see what feels right for you. Because one is, like, we spoke about almost the risk of not getting the balance right with empathy. I wonder on the flip side, how you would go about empathizing. Now, for me, it's maybe revealing about my own tendencies, but I know how do I explain it without revealing too much on this podcast? Like, my background with mental health, mental illness, I'm super sensitive. I've had to do a lot of work to kind of stabilize my sense of self, because I'm quite permeable. So I've had to really, like, refine those boundaries over time, hence the solitude that helps. But what that does mean is that it can feel in my reality, in a conflict, that if I accept someone else's point of view, I'm almost ceding my own reality. And the thought of doing that, as someone, like, go through my kind of history and also the reality of a lot of these experiences that I've had culturally, institutionally, are gaslit. And I say that in terms of the non-ordinary spiritual, however you want to describe it, as well as I had a spell, you know, spells of psychosis as well. So this is, like, quite extreme experiences of questioning reality and being in that ambiguous space. And I wonder, because I think you touched upon this when you said about communicating from wholeness, and it's like you're accommodating but not giving in. But I noticed that's been a theme where I struggle to hold that. So it's almost like the accommodating someone else's point of view feels like it's a threat to my point of view and what I'm holding, like it will overpower it. And then my point of view will just disintegrate and I'll just take on that other point of view. I don't really know how common that is, because, like I say, I'm aware of my own tendencies, and there is a holding of both perspectives. So I wonder how, if there is anything you identify in that ability to, I'm going to hold my point of view and my perspective on, it could even be meta, like what happened in the conflict. I'm going to hold that, not rigidly, but I'm also going to accommodate, maybe someone else has a different perspective on this conflict, how I was being, how they were being. How do you reconcile that without losing your mind? And I may be speaking personally there, but that's often my
No, I
first.
mean that's a million-dollar question. I mean, I think no, I think I no, I, th I you are not alone in that at all. I mean, I think that actually, I mean, what you're getting to is just how is perspective and also, you know, how people story their experiences. And so, you know, at some point, whether somebody said XYZ with an emphasis on this word and that sent that meaning, or it was a these words, then that, you know, and you get caught in the tension of that. At some level, sometimes you have to say, this is my experience of it, and that's your experience of it. So what do we do now in the gap, in the space in between? What is this? And that's the area to go in, because if you're arguing about realities, that's not going to be, you could hold up a phone that shows somebody doing something and they will still say, no, but it's taken out of context. And this is this, and no, you know,
yeah,
you made me do that. And that's, I'm not taking responsibility for that because you did that. So sometimes arguing about the content back again is actually not the most useful to get you through something. It's understanding the context. It's saying, okay, we can agree to disagree on this one, but but that's still leaving a gap between us. So how do we engage the space between? Does that?
Yeah, it does. And what it brings up for me is, yeah, well, I've revealed enough anyway. I found that is dangerous territory. Like I've experienced that, be it in conflict of perspective, where there's a desire to be right, that enters for me the territory of that unconsciously gaslighting someone.
Yeah.
And gaslighting, I'm sure you, as you know, like this is completely taken out of context. You know, it's something like the context of it, and that the how frequently that term's used. It's probably not fair to say that's that is gaslighting, but just being like, no, I really, this is what happened. I feel like this is what happened. You're invalidating someone else's experience through that. And that is also really so tricky to navigate. And something that has helped me that comes to mind, and this sounds so simple, and yet the lived experience of it is a huge shift. It's like, I could behave from my subjective experience, I could have the best intentions in the world. And I could behave in a way that I feel like I'm behaving with the best intentions, but it causes upset in someone. To hold that paradox almost of, even though I had those intentions, I'm aware that the way it's been received has caused a response in someone. And to acknowledge the way that it's landed without making myself wrong, or just to be like, oh, okay, so when I said that, it had that impact on you. I will actually try and accommodate and communicate differently, even though because for me, what feels like a good way of communicating, or even a way of not communicating, just overlooking certain things, is actually causing that person to feel a certain way. And the caveat, it feels reasonable that they're sharing that, and it feels reasonable that I would want to accommodate how I'm communicating based on, like what you mentioned, the investment, the longevity of the relationship. I try to think of an example of that to make it a bit clearer. But that might leave too much of an empty space in the
No. Is there a level of blame that you're feeling about that, or that you're carrying?
Oh, I've struggled. Yeah, like that's something I've really struggled with. If I upset someone unintentionally, and And I don't even mean by being like blunt or any, just generally just, it could be the way I ask a question or not being, you know, not being considerate of something in, you know, in that what's going on with that person. But if I then upset them, I've had to really navigate going into, yeah, self-blame. But then talking of the defense mechanisms would then, through the self-blame and the guilt, deny that I'm not, no, I'm not doing anything wrong.
Yeah, it's kind of like the one thing feeds back into another, right? The feedback loop. One thing that I sorry to sound like a broken record, but I think that the if you just think about the imperfection of the human condition, you know, it's natural. People are going to say things that offend people. I'm going to say things that offend people. Somebody's going to offend me. I get offended how many times a day? I mean, at the same time, saying, to giving acknowledging the human condition and the imperfect, that it is imperfect, and that. And to give ourselves and others a little grace in that, and to say, like, it takes the pressure off a little bit so that you can cut that bad feedback loop that then gets you back on the defensive, where it's like, might not have been the best way to have approached that. Maybe even it was a pretty darn bad way to approach it. But the fact that this is what I'm about to say is very true in my work with moral injury, where there's people oftentimes who have done incredibly, they violated their sacred values and beliefs in very meaningful ways, or they witnessed it. That's a whole other conversation, but they often use the phrase, "I'm a monster," or like, "I acted this way, it was so awful. I'm a, blah, blah." And they fight against it, and they think, and then they absorb it, and then they end up like kind of becoming that and feeling like that's it's completely pervasive. So one of the things, excuse me, that we talk about is the fact that you can acknowledge that that you did something that in that case, compromised your values, or in this case that you're describing, that maybe you didn't act the same way. The fact that you have that there, first of all, the fact that you would do that, it's natural. Things happen. The fact that you acknowledge it and you feel that it wasn't the best thing is a mark that is a mark of your in of a mark of integrity and dignity and compassion. And so what ends up happening is when you fight that and stuff, then it sends it into the defense mechanism place. And then you go. So if you can cut it and just, maybe it doesn't go back to that place where you can literally just say, "I know better for next time. I'm not perfect. You're right. I could have handled that better." Or, "You could have handled that better, but I understand. Like, I know where that was coming from." That sometimes can that moment of grace or just acknowledgement, putting in a sense of global meaning, putting it in the bigger context of the fact that the human condition ain't perfect, that we can it can that just that acknowledgement can cut some of the negative feedback loop.
Yeah, I appreciate that description. Like it feels like there's a symbiotic relationship between, or even just paradoxes everywhere, really, but a paradox of the more I'm stable in myself, the more open I am to feedback and understanding that relationships are dynamics, and
Very much.
take on board, this is a message to my ego and all the egos out there in the world. Like, take on board if you are repeatedly getting feedback. People, yeah, there are times where someone might be triggered, they might be projecting, But I really like you mentioned and you use the word grace. I like that idea of give people that act of grace to say, oh, you could be completely wrong, but I'm gonna actually allow, like, I'm gonna take on board what you've said and reflect on it. Because I see a lot of substantial issues in the world, also in leadership, also in spiritual teachers, being they convince themselves that they are right, that they're enlightened, that they know how to be with people. So they stop taking on feedback. They shut down that mechanism, and any feedback they get is just people projecting their stuff onto them because that clearly is not them. So it's like if you like one of the big practices in that realm is like just give people the grace. Yeah, people do project. People do sometimes, and this is where intuition, I find intuition comes in as well, because sometimes you do intuitively pick up on something in someone that they might deny. Yeah, that happens. But also there's that flip side of give them that grace, because it there is a mixture, and that's a really good growth opportunity to just say, just take on board that feedback.
Yeah, 100%. It's funny. I was saying I apparently needed to always have the last word, and now I'm very aware of it. And I notice sometimes how if I'm in a conflicted conversation or situation or something, and I really want to have that last word, because going back to the realities and where it's like, I wholeheartedly disagree, reject the reality you just laid out. And wanting to just go in and say, that's not true, but like, what are you thinking? I have a, empirical evidence a mile long, all this kind of stuff. And really wanting to do that, and that lurching back to what we were talking about before, to do that, to say that, to have that last word, to prove them wrong, to prove I'm right, and saying, nope, I can have my reality, and I can maintain that I'm sticking to it. You know what I mean? I may also say, geez, this person seems really dysregulated at the moment. They're not in their rational mind right now. So their reality is probably fairly distorted at the moment. And therefore, because I'm in it more than they are, I can then accommodate with that moment of grace and say, Michelle, you really are not gonna, there's no reason, you're not in a court of law. Like, you don't need to put out all the evidence. It's really unhelpful. Just step back, take that moment of grace, bite your tongue, do some deep breathing, get into a different situation. And almost every time that happens, that same reality is slightly different than when you come back to a different conversation. It's like somebody else might realize, geez, I was really out of it. That maybe, did I really think that? Well, I didn't mean it that way, but I guess it sounded that way in the moment,
Yeah, that bringing that back to my relationship, one of the biggest acts of grace that I've received, and it's happened before, but to a higher degree. This is going to sound more narcissistic than intended when I share this. Like, the biggest act of grace is knowing that I was right all along. No, that's not what I'm saying. Like the biggest act of grace is when my partners and what I really picked up on then is like when you with this understanding and this intuition, I think you're highlighting the point I was making around maybe that's it. You can intuit when someone's not regulated. And actually, rather than just be with that and know that when they settle, they also will come round. And for me, having that experience of having had conflict and feeling like I'm sure in this conflict, my how I see things is accurate. And I feel like they're being unfair in what they're saying, how they're responding. And then to have my partner be like, do you know what? I was being unfair then. And I'm just like whole system flooded with relief almost. Just like,
Right?
wow, thank
Like
you.
it's
Like,
palpable. You feel it. Yeah.
significantly, like a real really
Release.
affirming. Huge affirming process. So I want to acknowledge that on also what it's like to receive that. We spoke about, you know, the nexus on dealing with conflict, but to receive that as well, it feels almost disproportionately good.
Oh. And strangely proportionate.
Yeah, at the
Yeah, you
same
know what
time.
I mean?
Yeah,
Like
yeah.
it proportionate in its disproportion. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm conscious because we're on there almost an hour and a
Oh.
half. To draw us to a close, did you want to, because I feel we've addressed a lot within and flowed with it as well. Was there anything else you wanted to say about the conflict transformation? I feel like we've been talking to it.
Oh, yeah. It's a whole other
Yeah.
program at this point. Yeah, I mean, I think just, you know, to wrap up, I think there's essentially putting the beginning at the end, there's essentially three kind of main approaches to dealing with conflict. One is conflict resolution, which is about solving a problem. That can be good in some situations. It's not good in other situations because it's not getting at underlying needs, desires, perspectives, all those kinds of things. There's conflict management, which is essentially conflict is eradicable. You can never going to get rid of it. It's always going to be here. Best thing to do is to put the lid on it and just kind of keep it, corral it, maintain it, minimize it to the extent you can. The problem is that just lets it go on and on and on and on. And it's not actually doing it. It's not using the energy of conflict to make positive, sustainable change and opportunities for growth. Conflict transformation comes in, and because in the 90s, conflict practitioners basically realized that those two approaches at a large conflict, global kind of international level, weren't cutting it. And frankly, they don't always cut it. For the same reasons that it's not getting at those deeper issues at a personal level or professional level. So, conflict transformation is basically about creating something new out of the problem. So, it's not a we're resolving this or fixing it despite all of the problems. It's more because of like you're using what the challenge was as the catalyst for positive change and growth. And so, you know, it does go beneath and address it just the, you know, the superficial positions and interests that typically go with the other approaches. This is something that is very relational. It's very much assessing the quality of the relationship, you know, some of the stuff we already talked about, and you know, trying to see how the past, the present, and the future all can coexist. I've in a book that I just published, just actually just released in January, called "Holding On to Air: The Art and Science of Building a Resilient Spirit." It talks about something called a coherent sense of time, and that is seeing yourself fully. In the past, present, and future. And conflict transformation essentially does that because what you're doing is you are needing to honor the pain and the challenges and the histories of and the narratives, all of that from the past, but doing so in a way that isn't just exploiting them or minimizing them, but honoring them, meaning finding some kind of kernel of truth in them, a meaning, something important that can carry with you. And, you know, being able to, in the moment, you know, kind of transform the present in the sense of you're not fearing tension, you're bringing people together for open conversations. And then you are investing together in a shared future. And that's something you can look to the horizon and, you know, the long arc of the universe, the whole thing. And, you know, just, building something together.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's sustainable. So transformation really is about longer term invested relationships, whether that's, you know, global relationships, whether that's a partner, whether that's even, you know, your working relationship, if, you know, yeah, that's it in a really fast nutshell. That's mixing metaphors, but you get my point.
Yeah, no, it's good, because I realize as we get to this point, in our coherent sense of podcast timeline, we've already touched upon, I think, that transformation and the ways in which conflict can be opportunities for growth. And for humility and for grace and a lot of these themes that have surfaced. I'm going to draw it to, I've got another question to ask. Okay, well, this will be the last question, because it's,
okay.
Yeah, I think, so I think my question is, as a point of departure for people, and like around conflict, around value in it, seeing it for growth, what for you would be the green flags to say, this is the type of relationship to invest in, this is a type of relationship where I do want to work towards that togetherness?
Well, I think it speaks to your values, and, you know, I mean, ones that have integrity, dignity, wholeness, you know, I think we have relationships with people we don't like, you know, and sometimes we have to, but the relationships that we are, like our partners and things like that, we get into those if we're wise by looking at what our shared values are and being able to hold those as pillars for the relationship. And if you are, you know, so I would be hesitant to make a list of those, because, I mean, you know, we could list values, you know, 7 pages long, but, you know, essentially what the ones are that you hold dear, and when those are shared and upheld and celebrated and respected, and when they're not. And if they're not, then you may want to ask yourself if that's a relationship worth investing in.
Yeah. And use it for reassessment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you can use it as a point of conversation too, which is like, you know, this is something I thought you and I valued, you know, we shared this, and it doesn't, what you just said or whatever happened, that does not reflect that. Like, what's going on? Is that something that shifted, or, you know, just lost sight of? If it's lost sight of, then we can, you know, address it.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to put a cap on my questions, Michelle. I've enjoyed this conversation so much.
Me too.
I found it, you know, personally valuable, and I'm sure people tuning in will get a lot of value. And I'd like to talk with you again at some point.
I'd love to.
Yeah, that would be awesome.
Thank you so much for having me on. I've really enjoyed this.
Oh, thank you for taking the time and for joining me today. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Mind That Ego podcast. To stay up to date, you can join the Mind That Ego mailing list if you head to mindthatego.com/MFM. You'll also get a copy of my book, Mindsets for Mindfulness, when you join. You can also follow Mind That Ego on Facebook and YouTube, where the podcasts are also displayed in video format, along with other inspired videos that I create. Or if Instagram is more your social media of choice, you can follow me at Ricky_DeRizz. That's DERISZ.